Thank you very much, Bill. My name is Jim. I am an alcoholic. I'm a high school teacher, too, so you should be able to hear me okay back there. But if you want to come up closer, that'd be fine, too. A couple of things I noticed at the beginning of this meeting. Why is it that we don't give 2 months yet? Why is it that we don't give 4 months yet? Because I found myself in that situation. And when I had 2 months, and I wasn't going to get any recognition for it, I was pissed off. I wanted my 2 month chip. So, being in charge, what I did was go online and find a place that would sell me a 2 month chip. And I bought one. And then I bought a 4 month chip. And I bought a 5 month chip. And a 7 month chip. And an 8 month chip. And a 10. And yes, they make an 11. And I bought them all. I don't know if that really counts or if that's the way you're supposed to do it, but in my mind, by God, I earned that, and I was going to get that chip for that year. And every month that year meant a lot to me because I did not know how not to drink. By the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not had to take a drink since July 16, 2002. My home group is the Sunday Evening Serenity Seekers. I've been the CSR for that group, I think, for 5 years, and they've pretty much forgotten that there's anyone else that wants to do it. But if anyone is a member of that Sunday evening group and they'd like to get into service, I think I might like to try a different position. Let me just tell you a little bit about myself. Actually, I wasn't going to make notes, and I asked my sponsor, and I asked other people, so what do you do when you give a, I've got to talk for 40 minutes, you know, and if I'm in front of my class, it's not a problem, but this is, you know, we're going to share a lot of stuff about me, and I just don't know if I should just go up, get up there and wing it, or if I should take some notes. And so I went to bed early last night, and normally I get up at 5:15, well, I'm wide awake at 4:30, and I thought, well, I have this time now, I'll just jot a few things down. And I jotted down 7 pages worth of crap about my life. And I don't know if I'm going to get to page 7 or if I'm even going to look down and see what I jotted down. But I can guarantee you it will come from the heart. And this really is true. It did happen to me. So anyway, my childhood was, I don't know what normal is, but my dad left when I was about 3. Just so you know, right now I have a wonderful relationship with my father, and I pretty much have all my life. It's just that he didn't want to stick around us, and so he left, and so he kind of had the drinking thing going and the carousing thing, which is what probably bugged my mother more than anything else. But anyway, he left, and she remarried. She remarried a college professor. And he drank probably more than my father. And so we grew up in a nice home. We had all kinds of stuff in the house. We had a swimming pool. We had acreage. So we dug up a lake in the back, and we had sailboats and catfish and bass and all this junk. And I mean, for growing up, it was just the greatest. I mean, I could catch breakfast if I wanted to. Some nights I would just throw something out there, put the pole in the ground, and then wake up in the morning and bring in a catfish. You know, that's kind of how that worked. And it was just wonderful. We had cows and chickens and all this stuff. But we also had a beer keg in the garage. I really didn't pay that much attention to it. Although in fourth grade, I do remember doing an art project in which we were supposed to draw Santa and his sleigh. And I drew Santa in a sleigh, but behind Santa was in it, and I put beer for the adults, you know. I really wasn't that curious about it, but if I ever wanted to taste it, it was never a problem. My sister is at an AA meeting right now, a long way away from here, up in Susanville, California. I just sent her a text message, and I said, they're recording tonight, and she's so happy that she'll get to hear this, and now she's mentioned on it, so it's even better. But, But anyway, she told me, and I didn't know this, but she told me that when she was 6 years old, she could make a double martini. Okay, not for her, but she knew how to do that at age six. So booze was very important in our family. It was a part of nightly entertainment, and it was a part of entertainment whenever people came by. My stepfather and my mother played bridge. The bridge clubs would come in, and they would do their thing, and drinking was all a part of it. They were very liberal, and they would bring in conservative friends, and it would always get to politics, and with the drinking, it would get kind of interesting at times. But I really didn't, you know, the alcohol was just, it made my parents lose, you know, but it really wasn't that big a deal until my cousin got married. I was 12 years old, and I went to his wedding, and it was an Italian wedding, and so there was the white wine and the red wine, and I tried them all. And here I am, 12, and I'm mixing all this wine with the Italian food. And if you've heard me talk at meetings, I say a lot that my drinking career started with incomprehensible demoralization, because when I was in the back of the veterans hall, I had to dig my retainer out of the vomit in the grass, and that's how my drinking career started. The entertainment that night was a jazz band. Now, this happens to be a jazz band that I am now the instructor of. So they're playing, and I was somewhat of a prodigy as a young kid on the trumpet, and they invited me up to play a trumpet solo, and I had been drinking a lot of wine, and let's just say that it was less than successful, okay? And I remember when I ended up getting in the band, some of the older guys said, "You were drunk, weren't you?" And I was 12, and I was drunk. And that's the way it started for me. After that, there wasn't really that much. It wasn't like at that point I wanted to drink all the time, because I really didn't. I was a good kid as far as grades. I played some sports. My main thing was music. But eighth grade, I won the American Legion student, whatever, you know, this is what you want your kid to be kind of thing, you know. And so I was recognized as being somewhat of a high achiever. And in high school, it was the same thing. I did well. I always went to summer school. I got good grades, but the summer after my sophomore year, we decided as a group that maybe when we went to the drive-in or we started to do things, that maybe it would be fun to see if we could get some beer or something like that. And this is when I started to drink for different reasons. I began to, almost immediately, I began to miss class. I would go, we had a break at 10:20 or so, we would run to a store, get a quart, down it as fast as we could, and come back, and it was amazing what that could do, man. 32 ounces in about 10 minutes, just hammering it down as fast as you could, and it would really change my attitude for the rest of the day. But you know, I was always still able to just kind of blend in and continue to get good grades, but the beer allowed me to do other things. It allowed me to talk to girls. It allowed me to, for example, one time at a dance, I don't know why I decided to do this, but I was drunk, and I decided to see if I could be with three girls at the same high school dance. And for a while, it was working, you know, and then they caught on, and it was really not quite as successful as I had planned. But this was the mid 70s. I remember getting pulled over one time. I just walked into a store. I was 17. I looked about 13, and they sold me a 6-pack of beer or a 12-pack or something. And I opened one up, right into my friend's house. They pulled me over for making a double lane pass, and the CHP said, "Where'd you get the beer?" I told him the store. He said, "How'd you get it?" I said, "I walked in and bought it." He said, "Pour this one out and do the rest of your drinking inside." And that's the way it was then. And that's what I did. I went to my friend's house and we drank inside. You know, I followed instructions completely. And about that time, a friend of mine made me an ID, which really, really helped a lot. I got a motorcycle, and you might think this is really nutty, but I would cruise around in a Michelob bottle would fit right between my thigh and the gas tank. And I would actually drive around on Friday and Saturday nights on a motorcycle with an open bottle of beer right there. And I thought that was okay. And I never got in trouble for it. There were many times when I had run-ins and nothing ever happened. It was really, really bad. And I think because of that, I began to see that drinking and bad really had nothing to do with one another. And so, another example. We had a place called the Boxcar, okay, which is like this boxcar out in the middle of an orange grove. We always build a boxcar. Well, we had a thing. You flash your lights once, and then you flash them back. Everything's fine. Okay, we're there in the boxcar. We're partying. Nobody is 21. We flash our lights, and these lights go on high. So the sheriff comes back there, and he's talking to my soon-to-be brother-in-law, who's 20, and the sheriff says, well, if I search everyone, I'll probably find an ID. And if I search everyone, I'll probably find some pot. And I remember him saying, just like it was yesterday, there's no pot here. I had an ID. I used to call them lids, right in my sock. And everything that the sheriff went down the line saying, I'll probably find it here, was on me. But again, he just said, go home. After leaving places like that, I would do things like, and this was out in the country, and we had orange growth, I would turn my lights off, and if I didn't see anything, I would assume there was no car, and blow through two-way, not four-way stop signs. One time, almost killing my girlfriend and me, because the other car just locked up their brakes, and these were the kind of decisions that I made as a young person on alcohol. Another time, I had a Dodge Charger, and back to my mother's car, and I was driving around, and the road came to a T, and it was off into a gully, and we got air and flew. During that whole time trying to dig that car out, no police cars came by, and I was off the hook. We were doing a big halftime show in the high school band for the Rams and the 49ers. The Rams used to be in Los Angeles. And I was going to do a trumpet solo for 100,000 people. In order to do that, I had to march down the 50-yard line to get to the out of bounds. When I got home that day from school, my mother left a note, and she said, pick up the walnuts. So, well, if you're going to pick up the walnuts, you might as well pour yourself a beer since there's a keg. So I started drinking beer and picking up the walnuts. I went to the practice with two-quart pitchers full, and helped the other trumpet section, the other members of the trumpet section who were interested in that, and found myself trying to march down that 50-yard line, and found myself unable to do so. The instructor put his arm around me, and we took a little walk, and he asked me if I'd taken any pills, and I said, no, I don't take pills. I said, I was drinking. And he said, okay, I'll tell you what, you call me. He said, no, he said, I'm going to call you when you get home to make sure you made it. And I went home, and I sat by that phone because my family was asleep, and I didn't want it to ring. I was just poised, ready to go. Finally, I couldn't take it anymore. And I called him. I said, I made it home. So the drinking was now affecting my stuff in school. By the time I was a senior, I was blacking out. People would say, do you know what you said last night? Do you know what you did last night? And I didn't. On my senior year, I was a member of the golf team. We played at this nice golf course by a river, and we would take the beer, put it in the golf course, play three holes, and leave. About 10 days a week before we were graduating as seniors, my two friends and I were called into the golf coach's room, and this is a direct quote. He said, you guys have pulled down your pants and shit all over me this whole year. And if you want to pass golf, you better be there the rest of the time. And so we were. So again, it's not without consequences, but really the consequences were we're not serious. I really was enjoying what booze and other issues could do for me. It was all fun, and if I did have run-ins with the law, it never involved any punishment because of drinking. It might have involved speeding or something like that, but there was never anything like that. So I graduated just mid top 10%, and that really kind of bothered me because I thought I should have been in the top 10%, but I was like two students off. And so I decided I wanted to become a dentist because I'd had braces from sixth grade to the end of my sophomore year. And I spent a lot of time in the dentist's office, and I saw how much time they spent out of the office, probably on the golf course or doing other things. And I thought, this would be a great way of life. And so I go into pre-dental, and then I decide that with all the science and all those classes, maybe that's not for me. And so I switch to music, and that has been one of the few good choices that I made when I was drinking. I transferred to Northern California, and my drinking in college continued to escalate, and the blackouts that I was having continued to be more frequent. There was one occasion we went to the Stanford football game. They had this quarterback named John Elway. I really didn't see much of John Elway because I hooked up with some fraternity guys from Stanford who were serving a drink I'd never had before, which was called a Mai Tai. And we drank Mai Tai, and I was with one of my best friend's girlfriends at the time, came back to my dorm. I really have no recollection of what happened with her. I do know this, though. I put on a Ted Nugent recording and fell asleep. I got up, and the resident advisor had left a note on my door that said, "When you return, could you turn your music down? The neighbors across the street are complaining." And I was asleep inside. Might have been passed out, I don't know, but I was just asleep. So this became the norm. We went to a lot of rock concerts, a lot of jazz concerts. But I ended up, if I needed work, I got work. If I needed really anything, I never really had to suffer at this point. I spent my 21st birthday, I was working at a place called the Bohemian Grove. And the Bohemian Grove is an elite retreat for some of the most powerful men in the world. I served Henry Kissinger, Gerald Ford, Stephen Bechtel, Leonard Firestone, owns a tire company. People, I mean, just very, very enterprising, very, very powerful people. And on the night of my 21st birthday, when I came in, this old merchant mariner saw me. His name was Earl Jacobson. And he said, "You, when you drink, you change. And if you take any advice from me, you will not drink like you do now," or something to that effect. And this was yet another piece of advice that I failed to heed. Because Earl saw that in me. And he saw how booze made me a different person. And he's seen a lot of rough stuff on those merchant marine ships. And again, I didn't heed that advice. Well, anyway, I graduated from school, with honors, not without some, vomiting on the way to finals and, you know, the what I would think is typical stuff, but really, if you're not an alcoholic, it's not typical stuff, but it's the life that I led. And the thing was, I knew my material. What it came down to was, I knew my material so well, and I was so into the music that I was able to do well on their tests, and I could always play the trumpet and do that stuff. So I graduated with honors, applied for a job around here, and I got it. So I graduated, and 2 weeks later, here I am, 22 years old, in front of a bunch of junior high kids. And so I'm teaching school, and that summer I got married, and we had a daughter soon after that, and things are fine. One of the first things I did when I got married, though, was buy a refrigerator to put a keg in, because we had that at home, and by God, I was going to have that in my adult life. And so I did. The cake was a part of my life for a long, long time. I found myself later in life refilling the cake when nobody was around, so no one would know how short the periods of time between when I purchased the last one and when this one was up was the case. And so I had the cake, and my wife and I, she would drink, but not nearly like I did. And we had a nice relationship. The two friends that were on the golf team with me invited me one night, this was in 1989, to go to dinner. And I said, no, I was in the Troy County Symphony at the time. I have a rehearsal. I'm sorry, I can't go. And when they were coming back from that dinner in a car that I was in at one time going 140 miles an hour, the car disintegrated on a turn. And they were both killed. Donnie was a pharmacist, and Brad owned a supermarket. And this was the first time that I really had to pause and say, okay, first of all, you're luckier in fact that you weren't with them. But second of all, I know that alcohol was the reason, because they drank like I drank. And I've since started a golf tournament, set up a scholarship fund, which helps, but we'll never bring them back. This really did affect me, but it did not change my behavior. I continued to drink, and the amounts increased. This marriage failed, and I immediately began looking for another woman because I was dependent on somebody else. I could not be by myself. I could not have somebody that, I guess when I look back down it now, it's to take care of me. You know, I think that's what I needed. And 6 months after my divorce was final, I was remarried. Okay, and luckily it's lasted, and it's been good. And she's put up with more stuff than she deserves. I started this golf tournament for Donnie and Brad, and we started early that day, drinking Bloody Marys or whatever, and went late into the night. And I was about two blocks from my house, and I was pulled over. I had a keg in the trunk, and I'm sure I had been weaving, because I do remember a little of that. So this was my first really negative experience with alcohol. I was 0.24, and I thought I was fine. And so I was taken in by Visalia PD, and started the alternative services program. I had a wonderful counselor named Kiwi. She was great. And I looked her in the eye and lied right to her. And I'm not proud of that. I was told to go to AA meetings. I was arrested in April, and so school was out by the time all my court stuff was done, and so I could go to the Alano Club noon, 12 to 1, the shortest meeting I could find. And I sat in the back, and I looked around a room just like this and saw that I had nothing in common with anybody. And I know now that I have everything in common with everybody. But I wasn't willing to accept that at that point in my life. I could find nothing but differences, but there was one man that I do remember. His name is Curtis Jones. And Curtis got up there and spoke, and I listened when Curtis spoke. And I do remember him saying one thing. He said, it took you 20 years to get here. What makes you think you can come in here and get fixed overnight? And I thought, you know, he's right. But then it didn't change my behavior. And I really didn't stop drinking at all during this period. And it was just back to the same old crazy behavior. We used to have a Christmas party. And my wife said, that's it. We're not having a Christmas party anymore, because you get so drunk, then you can't communicate anymore, and we're not having a party anymore. And so this is the way it was going. People were telling me, you know, you got to slow down, and I was not heeding the advice again. In the year 2000, or just before the year 2000, I got this great offer to play trumpet on this rock band in Las Vegas for the New Year's celebration. We were at the Bellagio Casino, opening up for Harry Connick Jr. and his big band. It was just big party. They had the police dogs around to make sure the building was secure. And my sister called me. She said, "We're on our way." I said, "Trish, you're never going to get in." And I mean, this is, they have two checkpoints. This is the most influential people in Vegas here. And at 12:15, I looked down on the dance floor, and my alcoholic sister was out there dancing. She had found a way to get in. And so that really didn't surprise me that much. But on the flight home that next day, I was telling myself, this has to stop. And this was really the first time, January 1st, 2000, when I stepped back and I said, I can't go on living like this. I can't keep drinking so much that I don't know where I am, I don't know what I'm doing, and it seems like every time I start, that's what happens. And I somehow made it home. I remember stopping at the Burger King in Newhall and just sleeping. You know, just, I don't even know how I got there. And I told myself, this is it. You got to stop. And I stopped for 22 days. And that was the best I could do. A friend of mine came by with a guitar. He wanted to show me some jazz chords. And he brought a six-pack of beer. And when the guy comes to your house, what are you going to do? Say, no? No, you can't do that. And so my 22 days was gone. And this was the beginning of 2.5 years of what I know now as pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I remember going to a golf date, and we were teeing off at 7 o'clock. And I was really nervous because the guys I was teeing off with were really, really good players. And so I had something in a plastic bottle, and I had three or four drinks on the way. This is for a 7 a.m. tee time. So I took all that stuff and drank all that stuff, opened my car door, and fell out into the parking lot at 7. That was the way it was for me. There were many occasions when I was stopped by police. I can think of 5 to 7 when I had open containers in my car, hidden between the car and the door, talking to CHP officers, and never any consequences. So there were a lot of times. I mean, with the laws they were now, you know, I would be 3 strikes and in prison for life. But I know that my higher power was looking out for me. And I began finding empty cans and full canisters of booze around my house, not remembering putting them there. Things like that in odd places. You know, I would start drinking, particularly on weekends. I really wasn't to the point where I was drinking before my work. It didn't get to that at the end, but I loved the weekends because I could get up before everyone else and start at 5:30 in the morning. You know, and I would look for breakfast juices. You know, V8, and I would look for juices, thinking how would they taste with vodka. You know, and that, I really don't think that's what normal people do. You know, I really don't. It's that when they say restores to sanity, you know, I'm thankful that those words are in there because that is crazy thinking. I took my band to Washington, D.C. In 2000. This 2000 and excuse me, 2002. This was right at the end. And I had pulled our trailer down to Los Angeles, to LAX, and so I had a night there before I was going to meet up with 200 high school kids. And I walked into a store, and the only thing I could think about was to try to get something that I could put into my bag that wouldn't shatter and wouldn't, and I found these pint bottles of pop-off that were plastic bottles. And you would have thought I won the lottery. I was so happy. So I bought a bunch of those. And I threw them in my bag, and they made it, and it wasn't enough, you know. And I drank them all, and I told my travel agent later, who knows my story well, and I said, you know, I called you up, and I said, I need room service the last night. And I said, that room service was a six-pack of beer. That was my dinner that night. And that's where I was, near the very, very end. I took my boys and two friends of theirs. In my second marriage, I had two boys that are now, one's birthday is tonight, 19 and 17. And I took them to Hume Lake, pulled our little camping trailer up there and parked the trailer. I started drinking way early in the morning that day. Parked the trailer and couldn't get the trailer and off the hitch. So I figured, well, okay, if I pull the pin, then I could pull the, just drive away. Well, that didn't work either. And I finally kept wrangling it, but I'd already pulled the pin out. Okay, and this is one of those big anti-sway bar, weighs about 60 pounds. It's a big hitch. So anyway, I finally get the trailer off. I'm jumping up and down, and I get it off. Well, the pin is still out. So we drive down to Sandy Cove to let the kids play in the water and fish and do stuff. And the trailer hitch falls out on the road. Well, the park ranger picks up the hitch and asks me, did you lose a trailer hitch? And I said, well, no, I didn't lose a trailer hitch. And then you know, we're unloading the fishing stuff, and I thought, you know what? I think I did. And so she's driving by again. I flag her down. I'm .21, I learned later. And then she starts asking me some funny questions and asking me to stand on one foot, and it was all downhill after that. Well, it's funny, though, because it's funny now. At that point, sitting in the back of that park ranger truck, and my wife had to be summoned to come and take the kids, and at that point was the first time I really, really, really honestly prayed to a higher power. In the back of that trailer, in the back of that park ranger vehicle heading to the Fresno County Jail, I had my first honest conversation with God. And all I asked him to do was to help me and to take this obsession, to just help me stop drinking, because I saw where it was leading me. It had now affected my family to the point that I didn't know, after this settled out, if I was going to have a home to go to. I didn't know if I was going to have a wife or the ability to be in the same home with my own kids. And at that moment, I felt different. You know, it's not like Phil Wilson's dream with the white light and all of that, but I did feel different. I felt somewhat, if you can be at peace in that tense situation, I felt somewhat at peace. And I went to the jail, and I was given a phone call, and I had one friend that I could call. He lived up in Fraser, up in halfway to Shaver Lake. And he told me later that he and his wife were in bed, and they weren't reading. And he came down the hill and picked me up and drove me back to Hume Lake. And I don't know why, but that next night, when we're in that trailer at 2:30 in the morning, I woke up, I went to that fridge, and I had my last beer. And I don't know why I did it, but I did. So on July the 15th, 2002, I drank that one beer in the middle of the night, and that was the last drink that I've had. And I got back, and my attorney is now a judge, and he's reading the police report, and he says, why did you flag the policeman down? And he says, if you'd have just gone fishing, you wouldn't have had any trouble. And I said, Gary, I'd still be drinking. If that had not happened the way it happened, I would still be drinking. The judge in Reedley was very tough. He sentenced me to 4 days in the Fresno County Jail. He said, are you ready to serve right now? And my jaw just about dropped, because in Tulare County, it was pick your Saturday or whatever, and, you know, it was kind of like country club, you know, and Fresno County, it wasn't like that. And I said, no, I'm not prepared to serve right now. And so... He says, well, you'll serve next weekend, then, and you'll come in on Friday and go out on Tuesday. And my sponsor drove me up there, and I was out in, I don't know, 3 hours or so. I was very fortunate because of the overcrowding and the issues in the Fresno County Jail, but I was very blessed. So I got out of there, and the judge also said, you're not able to drive for 6 months. Now, I work 33 miles from where I live, and I have a class at 7:25 in the morning. And it was like, okay, either I get an apartment somewhere, or I have to find, I have to do something. Well, and this bus no longer runs, but at that point there was a bus that went to where I work at 5:40 in the morning and got there at 6:30 in the morning. And I rode in the rain, I rode in the cold, and I left at 5:20 every morning on my little mountain bike and went to that bus. And I tell you what, I needed every one of those bus rides. I really did. Because I had a lot of time to think about my actions and my life and the direction that I was going. At this point, I went back into alternative services with an entirely different attitude. In fact, my attorney said, you might as well go now. You're going to plead guilty. You might as well check in now. And so I did. I went early, and I had the biggest blessing in my recovery to that point, and that was getting a counselor by the name of Don W. And Don W. was an old postman from Farmersville, California, and he didn't mince words. And he laid it flat on the line, old school AA. And baby, that's exactly what I needed. And when Don looked me in the eye and I looked him in the eye, I could not lie. I couldn't lie to Don. And he said, did you drink for effect? And I said, absolutely. I didn't drink for taste. I bought ice beer. Ice beer tastes terrible. But it has the most alcohol in it, you know? And it was the greatest thing for me. And when I was trying to get sober, my oldest boy, his birthday is today, was 12 at the time, and he was on this baseball team that went on to win the Cal Ripken World Series. And we're going to a tournament, the Western Regional in Utah, and the first stop was in Mesquite, Nevada. So we go through Vegas, and we go to Mesquite, and the first stop, and I'm trying to get sober without a program. And the first thing we do is go to a casino, one of my favorite places to drink. You know, because you sit down at the card table, and they just start bringing them, baby, you know. And I had to do that on my own. And I'm with a bunch of baseball parents who are drinking every night. So I thought, what am I going to do? Well, I said, I'll smoke cigars. I have to have some vice. And I smoked a lot of cigars on that trip because I had to have some vice, you know, and I made it, you know, and in Utah, if you look hard enough, you can find bars. They're hard to find, but there's one in Nephi, and I know right where it is. Well, anyway, we're driving back. The kids won that tournament. We're driving back, and my wife says, I want to go watch another tournament in Bakersfield, and I'm thinking, I know what I can do. My pastor said there's a really good meeting at the Blue Room. And I hurried, and I got on 99, and I hurried like hell to get back to Visalia so I could go to the Blue Room to the Sunday Evening Serenity Seekers. And I got in that room, and I was met by a fellow named Kelly Dock. And I was met by another fellow from Texas or New Mexico named Chuck H. And Kelly wrote his phone number down, and he said, call me anytime. And Chuck gave me his card, and there was a little circle with a triangle on it. And it was like, wow. These guys are reaching out to me. And I hadn't had that in a long, long time. And I was in a situation where I was potentially going to lose my family, my job, my wife, my whole life as I knew it. Everything that was important to me. And I began to see that there was a way out. You know, which was going to be the title of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. A way out, but they decided on Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that prayer that I said in the back of that Ranger truck, that help me prayer, was really the first help me prayer that I've ever honestly, you know, I've done a lot of prayers in the past, but that was the first prayer that I really meant, God, I need help. You know, and at that point, I began this slow road to recovery. I mentioned my sponsor took me to Fresno. I found a sponsor, and I got into service. I was the literature guy, and then I was the secretary, and now I'm the CSR, and still are, you know, and service has been great. I did a 12-step call about a week and a half ago on a former relative, a sister's husband of my first wife, and sharing the message, you know, doing that 12-step stuff is something that is indescribable. You know, to be able to take the gift of sobriety and to share it with somebody else. is an amazing thing. And my church life has improved tremendously. I no longer drink before I go, and I pay attention now. But I will say this about the church, and I'll say this in front of my pastor, and it won't hurt his feelings. When I first went to church, I didn't pay attention. I was distracted. I was there to be seen. But I learned about God from people like you and Alcoholics Anonymous. For that, I'm eternally grateful. So, thank you.